Good morning, Tony. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm fine, thanks. Listen, I came to see you talk a couple of weeks ago, and I've seen you talk before, and there's just this incredible knack of actually making the absolutely gigantic, and when I mean gigantic, bigger than we can actually comprehend, into something that's actually reasonably understandable. Well, you do. I mean, you talk about sort of things, and then you kind of, well, say, like, the sun's over there and the earth is over here. If that's the size of the sun, if you look at a pinhead, that's the earth. It's that sort of thing. So the question is, because you talk a lot, you talk about sort of the way things are still going outwards. We had a big bang. Two questions related to that, and I'm sure that nobody actually knows the answer to these, but I've got to ask it anyway. What was there before the Big Bang, and what caused it?
That's a really enormous question to open up the interview, Tony, and you're absolutely right. I don't know. It's a simple answer, and I think I'm right in saying that we don't know. We don't know what was before the Big Bang. And you're going to ask me, aren't you? So what happens, like, what is it all expanding into
Well,
then? And
it's still going out, according to everybody that you talk to about the Big Bang and the effects of the Big Bang. The universe, or the one of the all of the universe, the whole thing is still expanding outwards. The question has to be, why and where is it going? What's there now?
We don't know. There are lots of models, lots of many, many, many theories. Yes, the universe that we know of, the what we call the single universe, is expanding. Actually, it's accelerating in its expansion. But as to what is it's actually expanding into, we don't know, because of course it poses the next questions of, is there more than one universe? If you look at the Hindu religions, they believe from many thousands of years ago that the cosmos was born, it had its life, and it died. But in that process of death, a new cosmos, a new universe was ignited. So it's like a series of universes. And that gives rise to the concept of multiple universes, what we call the multiverse. So many, many universes, so more than the one of which we are aware. So it is an enormous, enormous question, an unanswerable question
Yeah, I
as
thought it
well.
might be, but it's an enormous subject. And just to put things slightly into a little more context, because you were talking about one of the most famous constellations in the sky, and the one that you can see with the three dots, and the other bits, and then you came out with some numbers about the size of this thing. I mean, it was just, well, mind numbing in terms of size, and that was only one little fraction. But as I say, there is this way of actually putting things into some semblance of, well, size, I suppose, really, which brings us to what's actually in the sky now, because we've just had a coronation, and lots of big stars out for that one. But also in the sky, there's lots of big stars out there now, aren't there?
Indeed. So I thought, Tony, this would be a really appropriate time to talk about the size of stars. And just for your listeners, in case they don't know, the talk that you came to was one that I gave at Hursemseu Castle, actually in the castle, and it was for a really lovely group called the Wealden Astronomers. And this was part of the talk that I gave for them. And yes, Tony, you came along, which was wonderful. But yes, the exciting thing, of course, is at the moment we have a new king, a new queen, big stars on the stage a couple of nights ago for the charity concert. So I thought, well, why don't we talk about the really, really big stars, what we call the hypergiants that are up in the sky? So I thought if we just imagine getting into a rocket, I mean, one day we're going to be able to do it, but if you could get into a rocket now, at the speeds that we can travel now into space and visit Jupiter, it will take you about 2 years to get there.
What, to
Now,
Jupiter?
Yes. You do a few slingshots along the way to get you there. So you sling the rocket around other planets and then you pick up their gravity, and their gravity effectively slingshots you onto the next planet, which is, that's the process that is used to get spacecraft and rocket out there into the solar system and beyond. But if we were, so if we're using the current rocket fuel, it would take about 2 years. If we could travel in a rocket at the speed of light, mm-hmm. then we would get to Jupiter in precisely 43 minutes.
What?
But yes, but when we cannot do that at the moment. So even though, as I'm sure your listeners know, even though light can cover 186,000 miles in just 1 second, it's going to take 43 minutes still to get to the planet Jupiter. That's how far away Jupiter is.
I mean, to put it further into context of what I mentioned at the beginning of this, you're talking about sort of a couple of years to get to a planet, which in overall terms of the universe and the whole thing is effectively like taking a short trip to the shops, isn't it?
It's like not even stepping off your doorstep. It's that close. But the staggering thing is, if when we're looking at the sizes of stars, Tony, when you finally get to Jupiter, so even though it's so far away, in some star systems, so not like our solar system, but other star systems, in some cases you could be traveling that far, but you would still be inside the main star, because the star itself is so enormous. In fact, the biggest, what we call hypergiant star that we've discovered so far, could easily fit 10 billion suns inside it. Or put another way, 14 quadrillion Earths could fit inside this star. I mean, they are absolutely enormous. They're also very, very unstable. In fact, they're highly unstable. But because they're unstable, their surfaces are always sort of disgorging huge quantities of material into space. So it's, if you look at our sun, obviously you can't look at it directly, but most of the energy that is made within our star reaches the surface, what we call the photosphere, through convection. So it's like hot material bubbling upwards, and the star's surface itself seethes and roils like a pan of boiling water. And this process creates convection cells on the surface of the star, and they're typically on the sun about 1,000 kilometers wide. But in giant stars like Betelgeuse in the constellation of Orion, just one of these convection cells can be, well, it can take up about 60% of the surface. So when that's erupting and basically belching out all this material into the solar system, it's going to be feeding the material for future stars. So this is what is happening on these enormous hypergiant stars like Betelgeuse in Orion. But I think if you can remember from the talk, I gave the diagrams of just how big the stars can be.
Yeah.
And indeed,
the
sun
was
enormous.
Very small.
Yes. So the largest star, one of the largest stars that we've discovered so far is one called VY Canis Majoris, and it's a red hypergiant star, and it's the biggest star in the constellation of Canis Major, the Great Dog. So that's the one to the left of Orion. And in fact, I talk about stars having a surface, Tony, but this one doesn't really have a surface, because the surface itself is 100,000 times less dense than the atmosphere on this planet at sea level. And astronomers estimate that this one is so big you could fit 2,000 of our suns across its diameter. So it's about 3 billion kilometers wide. It's an absolutely enormous star. And for a very, very long time, it was thought that this was the largest star. But then they've been finding other stars as well, Tony. So we have another one called UY Scuti. There we go.
Catchy
That's
name.
Even bigger. That's even bigger than Canis Majoris. But the largest discovered star so far was actually discovered in 2020. Yeah. So UY Scuti has been dethroned by a star called Stevenson 218. Again, it's another red supergiant, but it has a diameter that's 2,150 times bigger than our sun. And again, in terms of volume, over 10 billion suns could easily fit inside it. So it's quite staggering, isn't it? And that analogy that I will share, which I do in the talks and which you saw too, Tony, is next time you're looking at that winter constellation of Orion, the Hunter, so the one with the three stars that form the belt.
Yep, that's the when one you I was talking
find
about.
That, yep, when you look at the top left-hand star that marks the left shoulder of the giant, you'll clearly see that it glows a sort of orange colour. Mm-hmm. And it does so because it is a red supergiant star, a massive star. And to give you perspective on that, if you could scale Betelgeuse and imagine it as the size of Wembley Stadium, then our sun would be the size of an orange. So if you can imagine someone standing in the middle of the pitch at Wembley, holding up their hand and they've got an orange in their hand, that's the size of our sun, the orange. But Betelgeuse would fill the whole of the stadium.
Yeah, that was
there
it.
There you go.
Kind of leaves you feeling somewhat, very minuscule in the overall scheme of things.
Yes.
Which is a wondrous thing, and it's a good place to for anybody that's interested in looking up at the stars and astronomy and wondering what really is out there. It's a good place to start and to understand the sheer scale of it and, well, realise that nobody's going to know everything about all of this, are they?
Absolutely. And, you know, the key thing is, Tony, is, you know, I remember being a teenager and, you know, I'm a country girl. I used to be taken out into the field at the night because the skies were really beautiful. And, you know, a friend of mine would say, gosh, look at the stars. And I would look at the stars and they did look beautiful. Mm. But, you know, it never really occurred to me to think about how big they were, how small they were, how close they were, how far away they were, whether they were hot, whether they were cold. They were just those points of light in the sky. And I never really thought anything further than that for quite a while. And I really regret that because now, obviously, you know, I look at the night sky with complete, you know, much better informed eyes. Mm. And it's stunning. And the stars, they are all different. They are different colours. You clearly see that Betelgeuse is orange. It's orange because it's a red supergiant star. If you're out in the early morning hours in the summer, and we're coming into the summer, that we have the beautiful summer constellations, and you have the constellation of Scorpio with that beautiful red supergiant star Antares right in the heart of the Scorpion. And it glows orange. It's beautiful. And it glows that colour for a reason.
I was going to say, moving on slightly from the stars to the planets, one of the things on your list today is Venus.
Yes, shines brightly in the west. It's up in the sky for about 4 hours after sunset. So it's absolutely gorgeous. You can't miss it. It's a bright white point of light in the sky. Stunning. And of course, it's so bright because it's covered in a thick layer of cloud. The entire planet is covered in cloud. Makes it highly reflective, and it's reflecting the light that it receives from our sun, our star, which is quite a staggering thought, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
it is.
Stars create their own light, pretty much, well, they do. Planets, when they're formed, they still do have some residual heat from their birth in that enormous cloud of gas and dust. But mostly the reason why you can see all the planets is because they're reflecting the light from our star.
What's the difference between a star and a planet, then?
Well, there you go. A star and its core, there is nuclear fusion, so it's creating heat and light. It's converting hydrogen into helium, and that creates the heat and the light. Put it very, very simply, it's nuclear fusion. Planets, they were born from the same cloud of gas and dust that our star was created from in the core. So you have the newly born sun in the centre of the cloud, and then after, you know, many hundreds of thousands to sometimes millions of years in that cloud of gas and dust, you have created, there are clumps that have got bigger and bigger and bigger over that time. and they still retain their heat inside the planets, like in Earth, for example, you know, obviously, you know, we have the molten core. Not the case with all the other planets, because every planet in our solar system is different, but they don't really create their own heat and light. They have some residual heat from that birth, from that hot cloud of gas and dust, but they just reflect the light from our sun, and that's the difference between them.
The other one that's out, of course, at the moment, but it's slightly lower down than Venus, is Mars, isn't it?
Mars. I'm not exactly sure where Mars is this month, actually, Tony, but...
Somewhere close to Venus, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is. They were quite close last week.
Ah, right. Okay.
And again, that glows orange. So, you know, if you look up, you'll clearly see if it's an orange point of light. Pretty sure it's going to be Mars.
Mm. Yeah. So you got those two, which are... our planets, and then I'm guessing slightly closer to Earth, or are these actually way out there as well? Noctilucent clouds?
Yes, noctilucent, night shining clouds. Yes, it's the noctilucent cloud season beginning in the northern hemisphere for us. And these are the high altitude ice clouds. They're about 50 miles up, so actually very, very close to us. And they're visible between 90 to about 120 minutes. So an hour and a half, 2 hours after sunset, low above the northwest horizon. Or you can also see them at a similar time before sunrise, low in the northeast. So these are the clouds that are comprised of very, very fine dust and ice particles. They form in a narrow layer within what we call the mesosphere. So, as I mentioned, 50 miles up. And they're highly reflective. Sometimes you can get them as a result of rocket exhausts as well. So a typical sort of ice particle is only about 1/1,000,000th of a meter in size. So they're very, very tiny, but they do catch the sun's rays. And it makes them very, very visible. They have that sort of, you know, like the petrol shine has on a water puddle. It's like that. Only they're up in the sky. They're absolutely gorgeous.
Is this basically a different take on something like the Aurora Borealis?
No, that's something completely different.
Because that's dust as well, isn't it?
Well, no, not really. It's not actually, Tony. No, this is where...
What do I know?
Well, no, but you do. But you've got the northern and the southern lights, effectively, is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And they're a result of the particles that are released from the sun in the form of the solar wind. So cosmic rays, if you like. These are pretty much as we were talking about earlier, Tony. They're blasted away from the surface of our star. They go well beyond the solar system because we get northern and southern lights on other planets in the solar system as well. And it's where those particles hit the atoms in our atmosphere. They excite the electrons in those atoms. And as those electrons are excited, they either raise up a level or down a level. And by doing so, they release energy. And the energy takes the form of light, of course. Depending on which molecule is interacting with the solar wind, you'll get different coloured lights. So hydrogen will give off red light, oxygen green. And those are the lights that you can see in the sky. So they are interacting with atoms in the atmosphere.
So we've this morning got to just about not even quite the tip of the iceberg, I think, really, when you're talking about what's up there to actually see. But what we've actually covered is actually quite a lot. But without actually even putting a tick on the page, it's quite extraordinary. Now, you mentioned coming into the summer. We've got to finish in a second, but you mentioned coming into the summer, not necessarily the best time to look up at the sky because there's an awful lot of light pollution. But
It's very frustrating, isn't it? Because it's the best time of year because it's lovely and warm, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's not just artificial light pollution, so our light. It's the fact that the sky, of course, is very, very bright in the summer, which means we cannot see the stars that we need to see until the wee small hours, and sometimes not even then. Winter is definitely the best for stargazing, but nevertheless, it's still a lovely time to go out looking at the stars because, of course, as the Earth is in its orbit around the Sun, we are now looking towards the centre of the Milky Way. So you can see the Milky Way at its best end of July, August. So that great sort of swathe of light from one horizon to the other, which, of course, is the hundreds of billions of stars that make up our Milky Way galaxy. And that is beautiful in the summer because, as opposed to the winter, we're looking towards the centre of the galaxy as opposed to away from it.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, it's such a big subject. We could sit here and talk all day long about this one. But, Jane, we have to call it there and say we're going to go take a look at Venus. We're going to see if we can spot those noctilucent clouds as well. And, well, hopefully we're going to talk to you again in about a month's time. Jane Green for now, thank you.
Lovely. Thank you, Tony. It'll be my pleasure.